more concerns about Ebola.
How does moderate alcohol intake affect cardiovascular risk in diabetics?
What can elephants teach us about cancer?
And tracing resistant bacteria.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on October 16th, 2015, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think I'd like to start with this study that's in the New England Journal of Medicine, taking a look at persistent Ebola virus, what shall we call it, presence, and its potential for infection. In this case, it's semen.
We've talked before that there's concern that even though Ebola virus appears to be absent from the blood and that if someone has survived the infection, is there may be reservoirs in the body where it's still persistent and can cause problems. And there are two articles in this issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, one that talks about the molecular evidence of sexual transmission of Ebola virus, and the other one that talks about persistence of the Ebola virus in the semen after it's cleared from the blood. It looks like there's pretty good evidence that a 44-year-old woman from Liberia contracted Ebola virus from a gentleman that had had it 6 months previously, and it appeared to clear from the blood, but in fact, she developed Ebola virus from him, and I say that because we can match the genetics of this particular virus. And that's followed on the second article, where it looked at 100 male survivors of Ebola virus infection, and what they found is that all the men who had specimens obtained 2 to 3 months after the onset of Ebola virus had persistent virus in their semen. About 65% who had it tested 4 to 6 months after the onset of the infection, and a fourth of the gentlemen who had it tested 7 to 9 months after the onset.
Of course, as we talked about just before we started recording, in today's New York Times, there's the report of a nurse who has sequela of Ebola virus infection. It appears to be encephalitis. We also have a report of a physician who was managed really well in the acute phase, but had persistent virus in his eye. I guess one of the things I'm concerned about, especially in light of this report, is the infection potential.
And that's a good point, because obviously if it's present, it's potentially infectious. And we do know a couple things, as in these particular cases, the ones I mentioned, even though it wasn't in the blood, because it was in other body fluids, it could be transmitted. We don't know what the risk is, though. It appears that the higher the viral titer, the more likely the risk of transmission. But in these particular cases, it's hard to assess the risk because there was no evidence of it in the blood. It was just in the body fluid. So we need more studies to define this better, Elizabeth.
I think the other thing that occurs to me is that other neurotrophic viruses, such as the herpes virus family, when we know that people who've had chickenpox, for example, can subsequently develop shingles, but we do have a vaccine that does help to keep shingles under control. I wonder if a vaccine strategy might work for keeping Ebola under control, even in people who've had previous infection.
That's an interesting thought. These people cleared infection, so they developed an immune response to it. Nevertheless, it still persisted in other body cavities, which suggests there are either immune-privileged areas of the body or areas where the antibodies aren't as effective.
An ongoing story, unfortunately, I think one we'd all like to forget about, but it's not going to let us do that. Let's turn from here then to something else that originates in Africa. That's elephants for the most part, although we do have Asian elephants also. A really interesting, I thought, provocative study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. What can a study of cancer incidence in elephants teach us about cancer?
So Elizabeth, you picked this one, elephants and cancer, and I thought she has finally lost her mind because I'm not a veterinarian. But as you suggested, it's in an American medical journal. It may give us some insights. We know that cancers are rapidly dividing cells, and you would think that the areas that are most prone to develop cancer in our body are where we have rapidly dividing cells, or in animals that have either more or more rapidly dividing cells. And what better example than an elephant, that between the time it's born to when it's 1 year old, it grows 300 times bigger. Obviously, the elephant has more cells than we do, and obviously they divide more rapidly. These particular investigators did an interesting study. They did necropsy, that is autopsies, on animals at a zoo. 644 animals, including elephants, from 36 different mammalian species, to see if there was a relationship between the size of the animal and the risk of that animal dying of cancer. What they discovered was there was no relationship. And in fact, the incidence in elephants is about a third of what it is in humans. Then they scratched their head and said, gosh, why is this? they looked at tumor suppressor genes, and there were more of these in elephants than in humans, and they were more active in getting rid of cells that exhibited any type of genetic mutation in what's called in vitro or lab research. This is interesting because elephants appear to have a lower than expected rate of cancer, probably related to multiple copies of this tumor suppressor gene. At least that's what's alleged by the investigators.
It's very provocative, isn't it? And I think is informative in that it helps us, if we can, understand some of these molecular mechanisms better. Maybe that points the way toward ultimately an intervention.
And I think that's the point of the study. I need to take a step back, though, and say, is it likely due to one particular mechanism? Probably not. This is an association, but doesn't actually establish causality. But I still think it's provocative, and I'm glad you chose this study, Elizabeth.
Most interesting. It got a lot of press. I thought it was rather kind of an intellectual tickle. Then let's turn, speaking of intellectual tickles, or into trying to understand mechanisms or something, to Annals of Internal Medicine. This ongoing debate about red wine, I have to admit I'm fond of it. I can't see myself stopping quaffing a glass now and then. Is it beneficial in people with type 2 diabetes?
And that's the issue. Obviously, people with type 2 diabetes have an increased risk of having cardiovascular disease. And the question is, does wine intake, which is known, by the way, to decrease cardiovascular risk in the general population, could it be effective in diabetics as well? The first step in that, you may ask, does it lower the risk factors? Because that's a study you can do in a short period of time. So these investigators did that. They found 224 patients with well-controlled type 2 diabetes, by the way, who were not drinking alcohol before they enrolled in the trial. And then they were randomized to drink 5 ounces of either red wine, white wine, or mineral water with dinner. And they did that for 2 years. All the subjects were given instructions for a Mediterranean diet with no caloric restriction. And then at the end of 2 years, they assessed their cardiovascular risk. For example, did the wine affect blood pressure? And the answer was, in these particular individuals, it did not. Did it affect glycemic control or control of sugar? It did. It did only in individuals that were slow metabolizers of alcohol, not in the rapid metabolizers. And then finally, did it favorably affect cholesterol? And in fact, it did. It raised the HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol, and it lowered the ratio of total cholesterol to HDL cholesterol. These are surrogate endpoints, but it shows that moderate wine intake in adults with type 2 diabetes is associated with a decrease in the cardiovascular risk factors.
I find this very, very interesting because it seems to delineate a population in whom the practice of drinking red wine is really beneficial. We've talked, of course, before about, wow, it looks like when we look at this again, in some populations, it's not beneficial and, in fact, may even be harmful. So this is that individualized medicine approach, and I don't know if this is going to make people give up red wine. I don't have type 2 diabetes, so I'm not sure I can make an argument for drinking it. I know you drink it also, and you don't have type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, I don't. I think the data clearly show that moderate intake can be helpful for people that do drink. The other benefit, this is kind of a side benefit, is that in these individuals, the sleep quality improved in the individuals that drank wine, but not those who drank the water. So for people with insomnia and type 2 diabetes, maybe a little moderate wine could be helpful.
Yet one more specific delineation, hopefully informative for some. Let's turn finally then back to the New England Journal of Medicine. An emerging problem, so-called carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. Wow, there's a big, big mouthful, or CRE. And what do we need to be concerned about here?
Well, Elizabeth, since you've already said it once, I won't repeat it. We're going to call it again CRE. This issue emerged in 2001. And why it's particularly concerning is that when this bacteria enters the bloodstream, the case fatality rate appears to be 50%. These investigators tried to determine the population-based CRE incidence and describe the characteristics associated with it from 7 different sites in the United States. And here's what they found out. The prevalence is about 2 to 3 per 100,000 population. About 90% of the time, it seemed to come from urinary tract infections. When you looked at the overall fatality, it was only about 8 or 9%. Most of these in older individuals with multiple morbidities, oftentimes associated with a recent hospitalization as well.
Yeah, so really not quite as great as we thought.
No.
I guess the speculation would be that as this thing gains traction, it's going to spread across the country to other places.
And that's why it's important to do the surveillance now. And then the other thing that these particular studies do is they try to identify the exact mechanism of resistance. Those were also part of this study. We didn't talk about it.
For right now, though, you would not suggest that this ought to be part of, for example, a routine panel. This is a lot, in my mind, like these necrotizing fasciitis cases we saw several years ago, where we started to look more carefully at, well, all right, where is this stuff residing? We found it in the nasal cavities of healthcare workers, for example. But it seems like it's kind of a steady state with regard to cases. So I wonder what's going to happen with this bug.
I agree with you. There's no evidence that routine screening at this particular point is going to be helpful. But once we've identified cases, especially those that have an active infection, isolating those patients, doing rigorous hand washing and other surveillance techniques will be very important.
Excellent. I think I will feature the Ebola virus study on the blog this week. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.